Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, home of the modern whitetail hunter. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon. And today on the show, we're discussing why, where, and how to plant native grass habitat. And joining me to discuss this is Pheasants Forever VP of Conservation Delivery, Chris McLeland. All right, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by First Light. And we're talking grass today. Grassland habitat, grasses, forbs, pollinator habitat, all that good stuff. This is our last episode of our habitat series. We've covered everything from southern whitetail habitat improvement to how to get started if you're new to this kind of stuff. Last week we talked trees, and today we're talking grass. And if you tuned into our episode like a month and a half ago or so, we spoke with another person from Pheasants and Forever. That was Bethany Erb. And we were talking about kind of large-scale grassland habitat issues, the importance of grass habitat, prairie habitat, grassland habitat across the country, and the fact that we've lost, I think, something like 53 million acres of this ground in just a little over the last decade. This is tremendously important habitat for deer and birds, bugs, all sorts of stuff, and we're losing it. So in that episode back then, we discussed high-level ideas for how, you know, we could work to advocate for new legislation that will hopefully get more grassland habitat on the ground. But today, I want to talk about what we can do as individuals. If we own land, if we have access to land where we have permission to improve the ground, what can we do to get grassland habitat out there? And why should we do that? You know, I know that doing that is not only going to be good for the earth and the animals, but it's actually going to be really good for your hunting too. So that's what we discussed today with Chris McLeland. Chris is the VP of Conservation Delivery for Pheasants Forever. So he does this thing for a career. His job is working with people to help get better habitat out there. But he's not just a pheasant guy. He actually has a long history as a deer hunter too. So he can speak to us from a whitetailer's perspective on how this can actually help us with our deer, with our deer hunting, and with the good times we want to have out on our ground. And that's our plan today. We cover a lot about why this stuff matters. We cover a lot about how to make decisions around what to plant, where to plant it, when to plant it, how much should we plant, all that kind of stuff. And then we spend a good amount of time then discussing how to actually do it. You know, do you need a broadcaster or a seeder or a drill? You know, do you need to spray? Do you need to burn? How to do all those different things. We cover it all today. So if you've ever wanted to put something in your ground, something like CRP type habitat that you see, you know, on TV that looks so great, and you see these antlers rise out of the grass and come walking over the hill. You know, that dream scenario. If you've ever wanted to live that yourself, you want to listen to today's episode as well. So I think without any further ado, let's get into this chat with Chris McLeland. All right. I am here now with Chris McLeland. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. This is going to be no pressure, but this is the finale of our Habitat Series month. We've covered, I think this is our fifth week of episodes, and we're ending with this one. So we got to end on a high note. All right, Chris, can you do that for me?
I got you covered. I'll do my absolute best.
Okay.
No pressure. Exactly right. I got you covered though.
Well, speaking of pressure though, I got to ask you this to kick things off. Your title at PF is VP of Conservation Delivery. At least that's the latest title I've seen for you. Is that, first off, is that accurate? VP of Conservation Delivery?
Yeah, that's accurate. I've been in this role for, it'll be a year in July. So okay. It's a new position within the organization. And that's the seat that I sit in.
Okay. So Vice President of Conservation Delivery. That sounds really, really important. Like, it almost sounds like you yourself alone are responsible for like the entirety of what Pheasants Forever is about. Because like, Pheasants Forever is conservation, and you're in charge of delivering conservation. A, do you feel that pressure? And B, what does that mean? What do you actually do, Chris?
Yeah, I appreciate that. To answer your question, yes, I do feel that pressure. But thankfully I have an incredible team, out there across the country that are doing the real heavy lifting. Really what my role here is within Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever is to put habitat on the ground, no ifs, and ors or buts. That's what we're about. We strive to be a force multiplier for conservation across the country, public lands, private lands, working with a diversity of state and federal partners. And my role is really to make sure that our field biologists and our state and regional leadership across the country, they have what they need to do their job to the best of their abilities and put as much habitat on the ground and service those partners and landowners we work with to the best of their ability. So my job is to make sure our team has the tools they need and then just get out of the way and let them do what they do best. So there's pressure in that, only because I've got such incredible staff and we have such incredible biologists here that, I never want to be the bottleneck or the pinch point or have anybody waiting on me. So, as far as getting good work done and putting high quality habitat on the ground, I'm just so proud of our team and just am thankful to work alongside them. But this position, this role is never dull, and I really like that. So, it's pretty rewarding.
So, obviously our audience is mostly whitetail focused. So there might be a decent chunk of people listening that don't really have a clear idea of how Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever works. Can you give us a little more clarity on exactly like how does PF put habitat in the ground, as you said? Like what does that actually mean in action? How do you guys make those things happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's been an evolution, to be honest with you, and we're kind of continuing to ride that wave. You know, organization started in 1982. We're a grassroots, volunteer based 501c3. Conservation not-for-profit, and we started very similarly to we have a very similar story to many conservation NGOs. Our organization was started in a basement and really grew grew from there, and for many years the way that Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever delivered its mission to put habitat on the ground was through our volunteers. So our men and women, given their time to go out and turn the dirt and put wildlife habitat on the ground, primarily on public lands at that time, some private land projects. But as our organization grew and our volunteer base grew, we started just asking some tough questions. So how can we do this? How can we do this better? How can we impact the landscape and as a beneficial and positive way to the fullest extent? Again, being a force multiplier for all the good things going on out there, how can we help lift that boat a little higher? And in 2004, we had the opportunity to partner to put the first private land biologist through Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, on the ground. And since that time, that program has continued to grow alongside our chapter volunteers. We have an army of men and women out there that are working one-on-one with landowners, providing conservation technical assistance on any private land habitat project they have. You know, pheasants and quail, that's great, but we do so much habitat work for where the objective is whitetails or it's wild turkey or it's waterfowl. You know, we go where the landowner goes. And so we want to help them achieve their objective. And so we have an entire workforce of, as our CEO refers to them as fire eaters, you know, men and women out there just eager and hungry to put habitat on the ground. We've partnered with, as I mentioned, state and federal organizations to help make those things happen, our chapters as well. We've kind of expanded now into the public land phase of this. So now we have, we're starting to grow an arm of our organization that's providing boots on the ground on those WMAs to help resource managers do a little more there and fill some holes and also provide additional public access. We have staff out there across the country that are working to create more public land for folks to enjoy and recreate on. So it's been an evolution. I mean, it really has been. But the way we get work done is not by ourselves. I mean, I think that's the biggest take home is it takes willing partners, willing volunteers, willing landowners, and where there's genuine interest and desire to do good things for wildlife, we're going to be there and do everything we can to make it happen for them. So it's a blessing to be here, and we're very thankful and fortunate to have made it this far, for sure.
That's awesome. It sounds like a lot of work, though. There's a lot of moving pieces. You've put in a lot of years doing this. I'm sure investing a ton of time and energy and blood and sweat and tears, all those cliche things, right?
Yeah.
Why do you do it? Why did you choose to make a career and a life revolved around conservation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm from Central Missouri. Grew up in a really rural community, great community, agricultural community. Most of my family's still there, and it was just one of those things where I loved being in a rural landscape. I grew up hunting and fishing with my grandfathers and my dad and my uncles, and I just for whatever reason developed a passion to be outside. This majesty of that there still can be unknowns out there, that there's still wild things out there, just always appealed to me, and it was something that just was a calling for me. It's a very hard field to stick with, because it can be challenging, but there was never an alternative for me. I wanted to make a difference and make sure that, there was healthy landscapes and plenty of wildlife out there on those landscapes. I was going to make this work one way or the other. And it's definitely been hard at times, but it's been the most rewarding thing I think I could have ever been involved with. And I'm just very thankful to have found my way to the seat that I'm in today. Even on the hardest days, there's still so many positives to be thankful for. And I just can't imagine doing anything else honestly.
Yeah, I love that. So what about on the actual land work side? You know, I see that you've got a family property where you're doing work on your own land and, yep, you know, improving the ground yourself and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure that is helping you with your hunting goals, right? But
yep.
But why do you do that? What is it about actually working the ground yourself and trying to make that place specifically better? What is it about that? Because this whole, you know, last month we've been talking about, it's been, you know, diving into, A, should you try to improve the habitat that you have influence over, and then how to do it? But I'm curious for you, like, yeah, why? What's your pitch for why, or what is it for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for one thing, it's, you know, it's like anything, you know, nothing stays the same. You know, one of the first things you learn, you know, when you're in, you know, chasing this career is, the term succession. What that simply means is, you know, as the clock ticks, things change. And so when you think about, you know, your property, and you think about habitat and the quality of habitat, you know, if you don't stay active in the wildlife habitat world, disturbance is a good thing. You want disturbance, because that's constantly setting succession back. And generally what that equates to is it increases the quality of the habitat that you have. And so, you know, from simply a recreational habitat standpoint, you know, I want to ensure that I have the highest quality habitats, you know, for the species I'm interested in on my property as possible. In order to do that, I got to get active. And one of the most common, I guess, misconceptions that many have is that you can overdo it. And you certainly can, but most of the time, you know, you're not going to be as active as you probably should be with your management right out of the gate, because it's just going to seem like it's a bit too much. But, you know, so for those reasons, I just want to ensure that I have the highest quality habitat that I can have on my property. I also, you know, for me personally, there's a legacy component to it. You know, I like to know that, you know, that this property, whenever I leave, whenever that may be, is better than it was when I acquired it. And, you know, and you start, as you get out and you start turning the dirt, and you start putting a little fire on the landscape, and you start seeing these changes, I think naturally there's this desire to want to learn more about what you're seeing. And I've seen that so many times with landowners I've been privileged to work with over the years, is, you know, you talk about what you could expect to see if they do practice A, B, and C. And if they do that, and they see those changes that you sort of predicted, there's always this, they become very inquisitive. Okay, now what's this flower, or what, you know, why did that happen here, but we got a different response over here. And then the more they learn, and the more, you know, excited they get, the more that passion for, you know, not just the animal that they're chasing, you know, it's the land itself, you know, it's the ecology that's going behind it, that's driving the bus behind it, that it starts really lighting a fire there. And that fire has been burning bright for me for a really long time. And so, you know, that's kind of why I get out and do it. And, you know, it helps make me feel connected to what I'm trying to accomplish.
Yeah. You know, as you were just describing that, it made me think of an analogy that I think helps describe something I've tried saying in the past, which is, you know, once I started working on habitat projects myself, kind of like you, mm-hmm, you start seeing so much more around you. You start connecting to the landscape in so many different ways, and it like opens your eyes to a whole world that was around you. You just never really realized it.
That's right.
It's kind of like, and I think you do some fishing. It's kind of like, yeah, putting on polarized sunglasses. If you don't have those polarized glasses and you look at the water, you just see glass reflecting up at you, right? But you throw those Polaroids on, all of a sudden you can see the fish, you can see the rocks, you can see the algae, you can see the wood, you can see everything underneath the surface. And I feel like as soon as you start working with land, it's the same kind of thing. It's not, no longer am I just passing through the woods trying to find a deer. I'm passing through a landscape, which I'm seeing all these different moving parts, pieces and parts now that I get, that I understand to some degree that I just never would have before.
That's an incredible analogy. I'm going to 100% steal that one. That's a really good one. It's exactly right. You know, and you just have much more depth and perspective to, you know, to what you're trying to accomplish, you know, and what it helps you understand at times. And you were talking about diversity and habitat structure, and it gives anyone the understanding that whether they have 40 acres or 400, there's always more that can be done, and you can also make an incredible impact, you know, on your 40, just like you can on your 400. I mean, it's just a matter of understanding what's going on and understanding what the limiting factors are. You know, the healthier that property is, that landscape is, the more diverse it is, you know, the more wildlife you're going to have, and, you know, all critters, but definitely the species you're looking for too. You know, so it's just a better, deeper perspective, and you know, that's sort of the end goal.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about then how we do it. You've got me sold on the fact that I should keep doing it, but let's talk about how to do it. Now, you, Chris, have been drafted as the grass guy. Okay. Because, you know, when we talk whitetail habitat, a lot of the time, like, food plots get a ton of press. They're very sexy. Yep. Everybody wants to talk about food plots. If I were to go down the line a little bit more, maybe we're going to talk about, you know, chainsaw work. People get pretty excited about cutting trees or planting trees too, right? We just last week talked mm-hmm. with some folks about planting trees, you know, putting trees in the ground, getting apples out there, all that kind of stuff. That seems pretty obvious. Something that doesn't get a ton of play, it's been talked about more, but still mm-hmm. nothing like food plots or timber management, is grassland type habitat. If mm-hmm. we were in an elevator, Chris, and you had like 30 seconds or a minute to pitch me on why a whitetail hunter should be thinking about grasses and forbs and that kind of early successional grassland type habitat, why they should put that on their property, pitch me on what your angle would be. Convince me.
Absolutely. Well, to me, it's about usable habitat. So if I look out my window right here in my office right now, I'm looking at, you know, I work out of my house. So I'm looking at my yard, and I've got about a quarter acre yard that I maintain, and it's short and it's lush. It's green. It looks good. But beyond that, I've got 80 acres of native warm season grass. And if you look at the structural differences and you look at that, the height and the density and the diversity in those natives, as opposed to what I'm maintaining in my yard, doesn't take long to see that 80 acres of tall, lush native prairie is much more usable at many more times of the year than, you know, say my yard. So for me, it all boils down to that. It's from a whitetail standpoint, I'm looking for cover in the winter. I'm looking for fawning cover in the spring. I'm looking for forage diversity, which these grasses can provide at different times of the year. And I'm looking to create more usable space on my property. You know, I live in central Missouri. You know, we're blessed with some great timber tracts, but you know, the landscape's open in a lot of cases as well. And so when you put that grass on that landscape, you know, if you don't have you know, a forest or a woodlot nearby and you've got native grass on the landscape, you still have incredible diversity and structure, and you're going to have whitetails and all kinds of other wildlife using those, you know, using that habitat, using those acres. Whereas, if it wasn't there, you know, it would be much less so. So, you know, you're improving the habitat quality by adding these natives, but you're also creating usable space, and huntable space as well. So, it's a benefit in many, many ways to incorporate natives, where and when you can. It's one of those things to me. I've never met a whitetail hunter that has installed native grasses that have been disappointed by the use and and how much deer are attracted to those habitat types for sure. So,
yeah.
I think they're a positive in many, many ways.
So I want to run a hypothesis by you. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a theory, I guess. So anywhere I've ever hunted deer, you know, let's say like the Great Plains states don't count.
Yeah.
So we're going to say like in an area that's not all grassland. So in an area that's mostly timber and ag or some mixture or interface of those two things. Anywhere I've hunted like that, where I find a patch that does have grassland type habitat, let's say one field got put into CRP, or there is a CRP in this property on this side, and then there's regular ag and timber on the other. Every time I go into an area like that has some kind of grassy component like that, that grassy area is the hub of activity. Almost always, that is like the hot spot for stuff coming in and out. And I mean, I always gravitate towards those locations.
Yeah.
Is that just me, or is that happening everywhere?
No, those have been my experiences. And it's, you know, for lots of reasons. You know, I have on my property, I have actually what we would refer to as a remnant prairie on it. So it was, it's full of natives, but I didn't seed anything originally. It was just there. And so through a little bit of management and prescribed fire, and I did do some interseeding later on, but it was always great whitetail hunting. And, you know, they feel protected because they can get in there. It's tall. You know, they can get the wind in their favor. So, you know, for lots of reasons, they can, you know, they just feel protected. It's an opportunity for them to, like I said, for fawning, it's, you know, same reasons. It's just one of those areas that they'll key in on. But when I'm hunting, you can bet I'm going to be looking on the map to see, okay, where is the prairie, the natives, whether it's, you know, remnant or CRP or whatever it might be, you know, where's the grass and where's the way in and out. And I'm keying in on that. And, cause I know at some point in time, they're going to be there. I can tell you just on my place, a little bit of TLC in that remnant prairie, getting that kind of whipped back up into shape, made a world of difference on the number of deer, and the quality of deer that I started seeing, just within a year. And the use is only increased. And, one of my favorite things to do actually in the spring is when we burn a third of that field a year. And, you know, there's nothing cooler than seeing a set of sheds glowing, right after you run a fire through there. Oh, it's pretty cool. And, so yeah, they're definitely a deer magnet for sure. Yeah.
Now, what about stuff outside of deer? I mean, you coming from PF and QF, I mean, obviously grassland type habitat is great for pheasants or mm-hmm. other upland birds, but what other types of wildlife and animal life or bug life do these habitats support?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you think about, you know, the United States, we had millions and millions of acres of native prairie. So, many, many, many species adapted to live on these landscapes and in these environments. So, you know, multiple, many species of grassland birds outside of bobwhite quail that utilize these habitats that, you know, either are ground nesting or you will nest in shrub habitat adjacent to these grasslands. And native pollinators, you know, far too many to name. The forbs, the wildflowers that generally accompany these landscapes and are in these restorations are necessary hosts and forage sources for the pollinators that we need to keep the diversity moving across not just the country but the world. And so you name it. I mean, there isn't hardly a species in you know, the northern Great Plains or the central part of the country that isn't adapted, you know, to survive or needs, you know, native grasses in some form or fashion. And so they're critically important, you know, for insects and wildlife species alike.
here's
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil made exclusively from regeneratively raised grass-fed and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER.
One more fancy term, I guess, that I want you to break down for me and help us understand. You hear about ecosystem services. So not only does a grassy landscape like this support a lot of birds and bugs and animals, but it does other good stuff for the land too, right? Can you talk to me a little bit about what that looks like in the case of grass? Because last week we talked about the ecosystem services of trees.
Sure.
How do grasses stack up?
Oh yeah. So it's nothing short of amazing, really, when you get into it. So, if you take your typical, let's say the grass that's in my yard out back here. So, I'm looking at fescue. I'm looking at a little bit of clover, but by and large, those grasses are very shallow rooted. Okay, so you're talking, you can take your scoop shovel, put it in the ground, flip a clump of fescue over, and you're going to have the majority of the root mass is going to be right there, just under the surface, and it's pretty sod forming, which is, if you think about it, it's a little bit like a carpet. When a 3-inch rain comes in Missouri, comes through here, what happens is it hits that fescue sod and most of that water runs off. And where does that go? Well, it'll find its way to the nearest stream. That stream will find its way to the next stream. And a lot of that water that typically would infiltrate into the ground sheds and runs off. That does not happen in native restorations or on remnant native prairie. Native warm season grasses and forbs are so deeply rooted that most of the water, when a 3-inch rain comes and hits the ground, goes into the ground. And so it's reabsorbed where it's supposed to go. That's one of the primary reasons why, it's highly recommended that, these natives are planted in areas where, like on CRP, where maybe it's a little bit more erodible. Maybe there is some more water erosion concerns. These species can withstand that and can protect that soil, can armor that soil, and help ensure that that water goes into the ground and doesn't shed off. And likewise, just carbon sequestration. Warm season grasses, native prairie do an ex- exceptional job of capturing and storing carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I'm sure in the next, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, we're going to continue to learn more and more about all the other services that they provide. But, when it comes to protecting the soil, increasing water infiltration, storing carbon, and the list goes on. These, native prairie just continues to impress and never disappoints in that fashion.
So it's good for the land. It's good for the air. It's good for the water.
That's right.
It's good for our deer hunting. It's good for any other kind of hunting we want to do. sounds like we should put grasses in the ground or help keep them healthy if they're already there. My question then to you is how can we as landowners and hunters think about, grass type habitat being a part of the larger picture? Let's just say maybe we'll try to create the generic hypothetical property that most people have to work with. They've got, a small piece of ground, we'll say, less than 100 acres or somewhere in that ballpark, and it has a mixture of some kind of timber type cover and then some kind of openings. Maybe they're farm fields or old farm fields or pasture, something like that. So it's a mixture of those two things. How would you recommend we think about adding grass as a part of that component? Right to my mind, I'm thinking, well, maybe I would, if I wanted to get better bedding on the cover, that'd be an obvious way to make some kind of grassy area for that. Or maybe I would plant strips of grass to act as screening cover to block off areas and stuff like that.
Yep.
But in your mind, what are some of the ideas that you've either done yourself or you've seen other people, or how should we think about how this is a part of the mix?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. This is really where the rubber meets the road. And honestly, when you're working with private landowners, the fun really starts, and I was going to make a comment earlier, I mentioned CRP. A lot of times, I hear that, CRP referred to is a way to refer to native grasses, even if it's not. Yeah.
It's become
CRP
like
or not.
The so generic like, yeah. Kleenex of things.
That's right. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But, but the reason I wanted to bring that up is, as it relates to, a landowner getting assistance to do work like this, there, no matter what state you live in, there's a number of opportunities for, financial assistance, definitely technical assistance to help you get a management plan and get the step-by-step instructions and the guidance on, how best to do this work and install these practices. And, but it all starts with an idea, and that starts with a conversation. And so, in my mind, the scenario you laid out, it kind of makes a difference on if it's an agricultural, if the fields that you have available to you are ag fields or if they're old pasture. That kind of, to me, it's sort of, there's a decision tree there. So if it's agriculture, old food plots or something that you're looking to maybe put some warm season grass into, my immediate thought is, and what I've had a lot of success with in the past is, okay, let's take a look at field borders. Do we want to install native grasses in 100% of those acres, or, should we, maintain some of those acres and border those fields? Now, keep in mind that a lot of wildlife, whitetails included, really like edge. So they're edge species. So the more edge you can create, especially alongside, blocks of timber, they tend to, be utilized more, not by just whitetails, but bobwhite quail or, ringneck pheasants, whatever it may be, because they feel safer. They can hop out into that food plot or into that ag field at any point along that edge. And then, at the first sign of danger, they can hop back in and be gone. So I look at that. How can I create and increase my edge in more of an ag land setting? And in many cases, there are little pockets and things like that. We may go ahead and consider, squaring those fields off a bit and filling those pockets in with native grass. But that's how I kind of take a look at that scenario. If it's old field and we're going to be converting, let's say old pasture to natives, I take a similar approach, but I'm likely a little more heavy-handed. I always like to err on the side of more grass is better, because the more grass you have, as I mentioned earlier, you're increasing the usable space, and you're increasing the amount of habitat you have on overall on the property. So I want to err on the side of of more is better there. And also you kind of get an opportunity to take a look at how you, you know, especially in a scenario where you might have old field or a field next to timber, you know, okay, how can we create some advantageous food plot scenarios where we can lay this native grass out in a way that's beneficial for you and create some opportunities for some kill plots or things like that. And so, you know, again, that's the fun part where you kind of get to look at the map and you sketch your ideas out and work with those landowners to ultimately land on something that they really like and go that direction. But the take home here is, there's a thousand, you know, no matter what the scenario is, there's multiple options that you can look at, and all of them will be beneficial.
Yeah. All right. Let's do some like hypotheticals then. I'm curious what your thoughts would be on some specifics. Let's say, you know, we've got, I don't know, our property is this kind of mixture and I don't have any crops on my property, but it's in an agricultural type area. So there are, you know, corn and beans and stuff in the general region. I've got timber and I've got what used to be farm fields, but the owner stopped, you know, the previous landowner stopped farming a year ago. So they're starting to go, you know, weeds and stuff are growing up in them, whatnot. And I've got a decision to make. I need to decide, well, do I want to put food on the ground? Do I want to put food plots in with my, you know, my openings here? I've got, I don't know, let's just say 40 acres and a quarter of it is open. So we've got, you know, 30 acres of timber and 10 acres of openings. And I'm thinking, all right, everyone plants really sexy green clover food plots and big giant bucks come walking into them and they stand there and just wait for you to shoot them. That seems like the easy thing to do. So that temptation might be to plant a big old food plot or a bunch of food plots in all those openings and things. If you had this scenario, 40 acres, 75% timber, 10 acres of openings, and you were going to decide how you would mix it up, how you would mix grasses with food or no food and all grasses or what. Give me, you know, in this very specific hypothetical, walk me through how you would try to balance things and map it out a little bit.
Yeah, you bet. So my first step is, and you kind of alluded to it right out of the gate, is I take a look at what's around me. So, you know, what is the limiting factor, you know, within that section that you're in, let's say, you know, so to me, it sounds like food probably is not a limiting factor, but diverse cover might be. So, you know, if that ends up being the case, and for this scenario, we'll say that it is, you know, I'm leaning pretty heavy on, you know, putting most of those openings in diverse native grasses, you know, something with, you know, like big blue stem and Indian grass, something that's tall, that gives me some structure, and high quality cover, but also, you know, 10 species of wildflowers in the mix. So, so there's some forage base, just not only for whitetails, but many other species as well. It's hard to get away from, and I agree with you, those lush Ladino clover food plots are pretty sexy and they look good. And I would consider that. I mean, there's definitely going to be some opportunities most likely for, you know, to include a micro plot here or there, you know, just something along the border. In fact, most of the time when we are, you know, planning native grass restorations, you know, the best way to maintain those seedings is with prescribed fire. And so as part of our, typically as part of our management plan, we'll encourage, you know, green fire breaks, which typically consist of clovers and other perennials of that nature that can go around. So we'll incorporate a little bit of that, and that would be something that I would look at. But, you know, if diverse cover, especially bedding cover, is limiting, I'm putting the majority of my open acres into native grasses with, you know, either relying on the fire breaks for my perennial food source there for whitetails, or potentially a micro plot somewhere in a corner, you know, where I can slip in and slip out with the wind in my favor, and especially during the rut, these are areas that are they're some of my favorite areas to hunt. So that's how I'm leaning. I'm looking at the landscape in totality, determining what I think is the most limiting factor, and using that to help kind of set my compass arrow with where I go from there.
Yeah. I want to take things to the extreme. So what if we kind of look at the example you mentioned, which was where food is not the limiting factor, but diverse cover is the limiting factor. Mm-hmm. What if we went to the far, far, far side of that spectrum where, let's say it's northern Ohio, like northeast Ohio, which I'm pretty close to. There's stretches where you go around there where it's just section after section with no timber at all. It's just, after crops are harvested, it's a flat, barren wasteland with nothing. You have no cover. What if you inherit a property out there and you think to yourself, well, gosh, I have zero trees or very few trees. It's all, it's a jungle of corn and bean fields in August, but come, October and November, there's nothing. I need to start from ground zero. What if I was trying to create all the cover I would have with grasses or newly planted trees, if that was an option? What would you do in that case? Would it be the exact same thing, just plant the same kind of blend and then add some pots in there? Or is there a different species or a different mix or something else you would use when you have that limited of cover?
Yeah, great question. So it's, it does kind of depend on what your objectives are. So if you're, as far as mixes go, definitely multiple options that you can choose from. If I'm looking at, whitetails as my primary objective, that's what I like to chase. That's what I'm looking for. And I'm in that part of the state. I'm sticking with, what I mentioned before, big blue Indian, little blue stem as my grass component, 10 to 15 species of forbs. And I'm putting as many acres on the ground in grass as I can. Definitely going to, have some sort of a perennial food source incorporated in there. Like I mentioned, I'm a fan of clover, and whether that's my fire breaks or, a food plot kind of snuck in a back corner or in the middle of this grass seeding, either way, it's going to be advantageous for you. And I've seen scenarios just like this, and those properties tend to start loading up about harvest. They'll start seeing more and more deer activity, and it peaks during rut generally. And stays that way all through the winter. We didn't really mention it before, but, native grasses, as far as thermal cover goes, for grassland birds or ground nesting birds, as well as whitetails, being able to withstand the cold, break the wind,
right.
They provide a lot of those, resources that critters need. And, when you get up in those landscapes like that, where there isn't much in that, much cover at all, and winters can be harsh, this is an important habitat for a lot of species, especially whitetails, but many, many other species. So I'm going heavy, and I'm going with tall, and like I said, I'm putting as many acres in as I can.
Now, what are your thoughts on monoculture plantings? There's some people that advocate for like a straight planting of switchgrass or something like that.
Sure.
And I know there's reasons for that on one hand, but what's your take on that? Is that problematic in any way? Why are you recommending a blend versus that?
Yeah, great question. There's definitely scenarios and situations out there where, for one reason or another, a monoculture planting would make some sense. But by and large, you want diversity. You want as many species as you can in your mix. And there's many reasons for that. We mentioned ecological goods and services earlier. Those are multiplied by the number of species that you have in your mix. Some species can tolerate conditions a little bit better than others. And so, if you have a monocultural stand of grass that's not very drought tolerant, let's say, and needs it to be a bit wet, and you have a drought year, and you don't have other species in that mix that can tolerate that, you could have a, you know, your planting could be in rough shape for a couple of years. And so you just kind of getting some added insurance there as well. But also from a wildlife standpoint, as I mentioned before, you know, wildlife key in on diversity. They need multiple species doing what they do at different times of the year, providing the necessary habitat and forage base that they need throughout the year. And so the more species you have in your mix, the more that you can offer, you know, not only the wildlife, but you know, the services on the landscape as well. So I'm always a fan of diversity. You know, the more diverse, the better. And you can always go back in later. That's something too. You know, I mentioned the typical, you know, native grass mix, if there is such a thing, is generally, you know, three species of grass, 10 species of forbs, occasionally a legume in there. But you can always come back in later and add additional species down the road too. So, you know, starting with a 3-10 mix is a good start. And as you get your seeding kind of into shape and you like what you're seeing, you want to come back in and add additional forbs or wildflowers, you can. So, but I'm a proponent of diversity where I can get it.
Okay. So I go to Walmart or Tractor Supply or Bass Pro Shops, and there's row after row of food plot seed bags of the, you know, the clover plot that's going to send big bucks my way, and the brassica big buck slammer mix that'll give me big bucks in December. And then there's the, you know, the forage soybeans from heaven. Like, there's 1,000 different food plot options that are marketed to me, and they're easy to find, and they tell me exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. I don't know many Tractor Supplies or Walmarts I can walk into where I'm going to find a 3-10 blend of native grasses that are just right for what I'm trying to do. How does someone go about finding this seed or the right blend? You know, someone who doesn't really know what they're doing yet and wants a little bit of a handholder or wants some direction, where can people get this stuff if they're not already tapped into the community?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, it all starts with who, you know, getting, you know, making contact with, you know, either your state fish and wildlife agency, private lands biologist, natural resources conservation service office, or, you know, Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, Farm Bill, wildlife biologist if you have one in your area, and getting that site visit set up and walking through your goals and your objectives on the property, because you know, every site's different, and like we just been discussing, you know, there's a lot of opportunities for strategy here. And so it's always good to get, you know, that sound technical advice on, you know, what to do and how to do it. And right, along with that, they can.
Sorry, Chris, I'm going to hit timeout on that and ask you to expand on this part a little bit before going further, because I think there's probably people listening that don't know how to find that person, or they assume that this person is going to cost them money to pay for them as a consultant or something. Can you give me some specifics? Like, how do I literally, who do I call, or what office do I get in touch with to get a person to come out and walk my property with me to do this?
Yeah, great. I appreciate you stopping. Well, first and foremost, if you go to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's website, www.pheasantsforever.org, at the bottom of the page, there's a link that says find a biologist, and you can click that link and go through our directory and see if there is a biologist near you, in which case you can make a request for service. Otherwise, you can reach out to your state fish and wildlife agency contacts, you know, whether it's, you know, in my state, Missouri Department of Conservation, you know, Texas Parks and Wildlife, and you know, whoever, you know, whatever the state is that you're in, reach out to the state fish and wildlife agency, and inquire about private lands assistance. And every state has a private lands program that can reach out and provide you with the technical assistance you need. Set up a site visit. It's all free of charge. You know, it's service provided to you. And so, you know, there's a number of different organizations that can help. And if you know, you need need technical assistance or you have questions about how to better manage your property for, you know, whatever you're interested in, whitetails, wild turkey, quail, pheasants, we can help you get to where you want to go and achieve your objectives. So, you know, and that is a tough, sometimes a question to answer from a landowner's point of view is how do I get started? You know, and in some areas it's not as highly, you know, understood or publicized as far as, you know, where to go to get this help, as it may be in other places. So, I can tell you that, you know, our staff, we have staff and just under 40 states. If you can get in contact with someone from Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, if we don't have someone close by, we can definitely get you in contact with folks who can help you. So that might be just as good a place to start as any.
Awesome. Okay. So then from there, sorry to interrupt you. You were starting to go good. Where we go from there then?
Yeah. So you've made your contact and you've got your private lands biologist at your door. What you're going to do next is you're just going to take a walk around. You're going to look at the property. You're going to see what opportunities are there. They're going to be talking with you about, you know, what your goals and your objectives are. You know, I would love to see more deer, or, you know, I heard quail 5 years ago. I don't hear him as much as I used to. I sure would love to hear more bobwhite singing, or, you know, hey, I enjoy seeing monarch butterflies when they pass through. What can I do to, to see more monarchs, you know, whatever that might be. We can provide you with the technical assistance that you need. Along with that comes a conversation about native grasslands and grasses that you want to, that you might want to install. And with that generally comes a management plan. And along with that management plan comes your recommended seed mix. So that technical service provider is going to take a look at where you're physically located at, what state, where in that state are you located, what species were historically prevalent in that particular area, and then take a look at your goals and objectives, and they're going to develop your seed mix. With that, you generally get a list of vendors, and there's native seed vendors all over the country, depending upon where you're at, and generally you're provided with a list. And you can go down that list and make your selection based on, who you want to work with. And so, there is, like I said, a number of great opportunities out there for folks to get their hands on the seed that they need. And those vendors also provide an exceptional service and can answer technical questions as well. And help folks get to where they want to go also. So.
Awesome. Here's another kind of, I guess this is kind of related to this type of question, like understanding what the right grasses are for your area, mm-hmm. for your situation. I'm curious about how you would handle analyzing a current, old field, like something that you haven't mm-hmm. planted, you haven't done anything with, but you arrive on the scene. Maybe it's because you're brand new to the property, or maybe it's because, well, here's a great perfect example. I think I saw you post a video, I don't know, last year or something, where you were driving around your property the spring after doing a burn, and you said you're heading down to this area that you burned, and you were gonna go put a food plot down there. And you get down to this area, you arrived on the scene where you thought you were gonna carve out this grass and put in a food plot, and then you said, "Oh, whoa, change of plans. I see milkweed, and I see this stuff, and I see this stuff, and I see this stuff. There's no way I'm going to get rid of this. I've got to keep this." How do you go about making that decision? What did you see there that made you realize, oh, this is worth keeping? We're not going to get rid of this. Or, you know, more generically, if someone's looking at an old field or a new field or something that they don't know about, how can they go about judging how high a quality of habitat that is, or how important that is? And if they need to change it or just nurture it?
Yeah, great question. So, one thing to keep in mind is, and in that video that you saw, so that was an old field originally when I bought that property that had some remnant native prairie in it. So when I bought it, you know, one of the first things I did was kind of take a look around, and, you know, it was old pasture at one time. And so there was, you know, there was some cool season grasses in there and things that, you know, it was providing some habitat, but I would see, you know, a clump of big blue stem over here and, you know, maybe a wildflower over there. And, you know, the seed bank, no matter where you live, there are natives in the seed bank. Those seeds are there. And it's kind of a, it all really depends on how degraded that system might be as to, okay, can I bring this back with a little bit of fire and herbicide, or do I need to go down the road of putting a native, you know, going in and prepping it and just doing a restoration and do a seeding. And so I'm looking for keys. And in that particular case, you know, milkweed is a, very, very important to monarch butterflies. And it's also, you know, something that, you know, believe it or not, it's sort of limited on the landscape these days. And so, I was going down there. I was going to put in a perennial plot along this stream. And, we had just done some burning earlier in the year and came back, and sure enough, there was a whole bunch of milkweed there. And so I always err on the side of diversity, like I said earlier. So that was not something I planted in that particular spot there, but it was there. And my property is going to be better the more diverse it is. So for me to have rototilled that and prepped it and went in with clover in that particular spot, wasn't going to maximize everything that my property could be. So I pivoted and moved and went to a different spot, and it all worked out, for the better. But, you know, looking at those old field situations, you can kind of tell based on if you're seeing remnant natives present versus none at all. That kind of tells you, okay, whether you've got something to work with here or whether you're looking at a complete burn down and then reseeding. And in this particular case, I did both. I had a, you know, kind of had the field split in half. I had a little bit more remnant on one half, a lot less on the other. I did a restoration on one half, and I did some burning and some herbicide application at the right time and brought the other half back. And so, you know, it isn't an exact science, but again, it's working the land, you know, and it's working with what you have and making management decisions that you think ultimately are going to help you get to where you want to go. And it's a really fun process along the way. And, you know, the thing I would say too is, you know, habitat management, there was a Bob Ross said, you know, there's no mistakes, only happy accidents. It's very much like that.
Yeah.
You know, you are afforded the opportunity to learn as you go. And, you know, there's nothing generally that's too bad that you can't go back and learn from and correct later. So it's really it's low risk, high reward, you know, kind of activity. So.
Yeah.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MeatEater.
Let's say we've either discovered an opening that we want to improve and manage, or, well, I guess this is probably two separate tracks, I suppose. There's probably one track, which is, how do I plant something that is not currently in grasses? It's either an old crop field or an old pasture or something, or it's timber and now it's open. So I guess part one is, I'd love to talk to you about how do we go about planting new grasses, a new blend. And then the second avenue will be then, what if we have something old, some remnant, and we want to manage it and improve it? Can you walk me through the step-by-step, you know, how do we prep and actually do this stuff? Because it's, I mean, is it just like planting a food plot, or would you say it's different?
It's different. It is. And, you know, the thing I would say too is the techniques are the same, but the way that you do it is takes a little bit more finesse. So let's take the scenario that you have a crop field, and you've decided that you're going to put native grasses or field borders into this crop field. In my opinion, that's the best case scenario if you're doing a, you know, you're actually going to do a seeding. The reason for that is, like anything else, this is where it's similar to putting a food plot in. It all starts with your site prep. If you do not go 100% all in on your site prep, you could have some challenge. You almost will always have some challenges with your seeding. So site prep is incredibly important. And, you know, typically if I had a landowner that, let's say they had an old fescue pasture, it wasn't being farmed at the moment, but they wanted to go do a native restoration on those acres, I would encourage them to plant, let's say, soybeans for 2 years, something Roundup ready, you know, get beans there, get that cool season competition under control. That's really, really important. So going into a
can I ask you a question?
You bet. Go ahead.
Real quick, you've mentioned the cool season competition, and mm-hmm. and something that I've heard over the years and have had to pick up on my own, but I think a lot of people that aren't really savvy on this stuff won't really understand the difference between like cool season grasses and warm season grasses, or
you bet.
Something like that. Can you just explain that a little bit?
You bet. Yeah. I appreciate you stopping me there. I should have done that early. So cool season and warm season grasses. So they're native varieties and non-native varieties of both that exist on the landscape today. Warm season grasses grow when the soil temperatures are warmer, reach a certain degree level. It kind of varies depending upon the species, but they're actively growing during the warm part of the year. Cool season grasses are growing during the spring and the fall, typically dormant during the summer. So, for example, right now we're in April, you know, looking out my window here, looking at my yard, you know, I've got fescue and some brome out there. It's lush and it's green. It's growing right now. So that's a cool season grass, as okay. opposed to the warm season, which is, you know, starting to green up here around here where we're at, especially if they've burned, but that's the difference.
Okay. And is it typically those cool season grasses that are trouble for some of our more preferred plantings, because they start going early outcompete whatever you planted, and then you get this really patchy or poor growth of what you actually want. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the, you know, especially in a new seeding, the first 3 years are the most critical for a native warm season grass seeding. So when you've got a cool season competition, you know, they're competing for the same resources. And so, especially something like fescue that's sod forming as those native seedlings are coming up through the ground, that fescue can really overtake them and shade them out and outcompete them. So you want to really make sure that you're staying on top of that and you're diligent. But if you do a very good job of your, you know, of site prep, you're pretty well got the battle won right away. So that's kind of where I come back to. If you had, in the best case scenario, you're going into an area that's, you know, had multiple applications of glyphosate or Roundup applied, whether that is just through chemical burn down, you know, you've come, you've mowed your fescue off, you've sprayed it twice the previous fall, burn that residue off, come back with one more application in the spring, or you're going into an area that has been routinely cropped every year. You've got a great seed bed prepped. There's no weed competition. You've got plenty of bare soil. Now you're ready to put your seed down. There's two ways to do that. You can either broadcast seed your natives with a carrier of some type, you know, whether that's vermiculite or something that you can put into the your broadcast seeder that can agitate and also carry that seed. The native seed is incredibly light, very, very fluffy. It's adapted to be spread by wind. So, you know, it's can be tough to get out the back of a seeder, but a seed, you know, a spreader like a Vicon that has a, you know, a dog tail on the back that can really agitate, that's a great tool to use. You want to see, and it's actually broadcast seeding is my preferred method of seeding natives. I like to go in, as long as the site prep's been done very well, I got plenty of bare ground. I like to go in during the winter months, you know, January, February, right before snow in my area is ideal. Go in and broadcast seed, let that snow get on top of it, and then the freeze thaw in the spring, that motion just works that seed in into the ground just perfect. And I really like broadcast seeding. But the other way you can do it is with a warm season grass drill. So it looks a lot like a grain drill, only it has agitators inside the hopper that can help seed the native seed. And what you're really trying to do, and this is, again, a situation where the technique is similar to planting a food plot, but it is different. You only need that native seed to be in, I mean, about half as deep as your thumbnail is long. It just needs a little bit of coverage. It doesn't need a lot. If you you plant that seed too deep, it's not gonna grow. So if you use the drill, you're just wanting to have those cultures scratching the surface. That's just deep enough. But you know, you get good seed to soil contact that way. It's another great method for planting your grasses. So you've got the seed on the ground. You've either broadcast seeded it or you have drilled it. Now comes the fun part, and that's when you get to kind of just sit back and watch. So year one, don't expect a lot. Those natives are they're growing, but they're growing underground. So that first year, they're putting their roots down. Remember I mentioned compass plant, for example, is a very, very tall native native plant, but it can have a root, a tap root, as deep as 25 feet. So it's wow. it's putting its roots down. So don't be expecting, you know, lush big CRP looking fields the first year. It's coming. Trust me, it's coming. But that first year, they're putting the roots down. What you're really looking at that first year is competition. So this is where anyone who's going to do this work, whether they think they will, you know, this is going to happen to them or not, they'll kind of become very proficient in plant identification, because they're going to be out there looking. and they're going to learn how to identify natives versus unwanted species. And so you're looking out there, you're just kind of seeing what you have. It's going to be weedy. That's okay. There's going to be annuals that come up in it. That's going to be just fine. It's actually providing some habitat for some annual habitat for wildlife. This is where you need to have a mower handy. So it's okay. And we highly recommend at least twice a year in most areas to come in and clip that seeding down. And what you're doing is you're just keeping the playing field level at that point. So there will be a little bit of competition no matter how good your site prep is. You'll have some. So through mowing a couple of times a year, you're just kind of keeping everything controlled while those natives are putting the roots down. Second year, second growing season, you're going to start seeing wildflowers at this point. You're going to start seeing bunches of big blue and Indian grass and whatever bunch grasses you have in your mix. You're going to start seeing these start to really show themselves, and you might be ready to rock and roll at this point. It just kind of depends on weather conditions and a number of things. I've seen second year plantings take off and look incredible, and you're up and running. Most of the time, you're looking to clip, to mow at least once during year two. And so that's kind of a judgment call, and you can work with your private lands biologist that you've worked with on the project to kind of determine when to make that call. But generally, as a rule of thumb, I'm looking to mow once that second year. By year three, you should have an established, fully established grassland restoration project on your hands. And you're up and off to the races at that point. And by then, once it's established and ready to go, prescribed fire is going to be your friend. You know, this work is fun. You know, it does require some patience. But there's a lot of a benefit that comes from, getting some expertise around learning how to use prescribed fire. And that's the best management tool you're ever going to have, to manage your grasses. And so by year three, you ought to be looking at, okay, it's about time for a burn. And when you burn, it kind of depends on what your objectives are. So, you can burn your natives anytime during the dormant season. And if you burn them, early, let's say January, February, that tends to favor wildflowers, more diversity. You burn them a little bit later, tends to favor grasses, a little bit more cover. All the things that you can work with your local point of contact on to make the determination that's best for you. But that's sort of the timeline really for putting this work on the ground and getting a project from start to finish.
Okay. So then what about scenario two, where I've got an old field or something that I think that I've got something to work with, but I don't exactly know what, and I want to try to turn this thing into something worthwhile. What then?
You bet. So these are a lot of fun, actually, and they're very common. So scenario two, you go into an old field, you're walking around with your private lands biologist, and you're identifying, they make the decision, hey, we might have something to work with here. I'm seeing some remnant. You've got a lot of unwanted cool seasons in here, but this is probably salvageable. Your two primary go-to practices are going to be herbicide and fire. So you're going to look at that situation, and based on the recommendations of your point of contact there, you're going to have likely an opportunity or a recommendation rather to apply some form of herbicide in the fall. Now this can be, this can change depending upon, what they see out there, but generally you're going to be putting a grass selective herbicide, down in the fall. So something that's going to be targeting those cool seasons that's in there, and some of those unwanted species that are in there. Your natives are going to be dormant, especially if you wait until after the first hard frost. Your natives will almost always be dormant anytime after that. And if you're working with a you know, an unwanted cool season like fescue, you can spray that almost any time if the ambient air temperature is somewhere in that 50 degree mark. I've had some great results spraying fescue out of remnant native stands in the middle of December in central Missouri when we've had, you know, a couple day warm shot there where we're in the 50s. And so you're going to go in October, end of October, if you're in the central part of the U.S., and you're going to apply, you know, either a grass selective herbicide or in some cases just a light application of Roundup and start setting that unwanted cool season back. You're going to watch that over the winter, see how it progresses. Generally, in most cases, you're going to come back the next spring with a prescribed fire, and you're going to run fires through there. That's going to continue to work on those unwanted cool seasons, set them back a little bit more, while at the same time, that fire generates a response from the natives. So between the application of the herbicide and the incorporation of the fire, you're really knocking back the cool season, and you're giving those natives a kickstart. And again, it's about succession and competition. So you can get that cool season set back just enough to where those natives are kickstarted enough to where they're up over the top. Generally, you're off to the races, and you might have to repeat that process the following fall. But generally, in a couple of years, especially if you have a really good seed bank that has diverse native seeds in there, you'll be in good shape. And the best part about that particular situation where you're going into a remnant scenario is it's incredibly cost effective. You know, a little bit of herbicide, you know, $80 jug of glyphosate or select or something like that, and a little bit of diesel and gasoline in a drip torch, and you can have some incredibly beneficial high quality habitat on your hands in just a couple of years.
Now, what about long term management in both scenarios? Let's say you've got your great stand of native grasses like you want them. Is it then just applying fire at some interval for perpetuity, or is mowing ever a tool you would use at that point ever again? Any selective spraying of shrubs or something popping up? Anything else like that?
Yeah, it's all three. So you kind of want to, you know, I guess first and foremost, you know, once you have your grass established, you're really looking at, you know, not just your grasslands at that point, but how does that all fit within your property? And so you're really wanting to manage, you know, on sort of a one-third rotation. So you want to see some sort of active management on one-third of your property a year. And if it's all grassland, that's great. You're going to be burning or disking or mowing a third a year. If it's in my case, you know, in my property, I've got mixed woods and grassland habitats. And so I'm using a lot of prescribed fire, burning both my woodlands and my grasslands about a third a year. So, but for the purposes of, you know, grassland management, you're really looking at disking, mowing, prescribed fire, or herbicides. So you have four primary tools at your disposal. All are great. They all have their benefits, and there are definitely scenarios where some favor are more favorable than the other. But I always lean heavily on fire. It's like I said, it's inexpensive. It's a very impactful management tool for a number of reasons. And it's something that's, that when done correctly is can really give you your best benefits, your best bang for your buck there. But there definitely are instances where, you know, mowing is going to make some sense. Disking, especially if you have older plantings that maybe are very grass dominated and you're wanting to improve some diversity, get some diversity back into that stand, you know, disking can be a very effective tool in that case. Same with herbicide application too. So it just kind of all depends, but those are going to be your four primary management tools that you're going to want to have at the ready is, good mower a sprayer, a drip torch, and a disc, and you're going to be set.
All right. So the one roadblock, I don't know if this is a roadblock, but this is like a potential red flag for me as I'm working mm-hmm. through this for myself. It's like, man, this sounds like a lot of kind of energy and time and maybe money getting put into this. I've got to figure out a way to rent a seeder. I've got to figure out a way to buy this herbicide. I've got to, get this thing and that thing. If there's someone worrying about that kind of thing, I imagine that the government programs out there to help fund some of this stuff might be helpful, like the CRP program or yep. others. Can you dive further into that? Because we talked a little bit about how there's free consultation services sometimes, but there's also programs where, the government is incentivizing private landowners to do work like this and even sometimes compensating you for it. Can you give us the cliff notes on what kind of programs we should look for specifically and how to do that?
Absolutely. And, I'll just start by saying that it's really been, it's been pretty incredible to see the amount of horsepower and emphasis being placed on, grassland habitat restoration across the country. And the interest that's out there in voluntary conservation practices to put grasslands on the landscape and to help landowners make that happen and achieve their objectives, there's been significant resources put into both state and federal programs to help offset the costs of a number of this work or a lot of this work. So, to start right out with the program that most folks are familiar with, the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, that continues to be a very, very impactful and popular program for landowners to participate in. It's completely voluntary. It provides the landowner with an annual rental payment for those acres that go into the program. There's additional funding available in most cases to offset the restoration costs, so like the drill rental and the seed costs and things along those lines. And that program is a U.S. Department of Ag administered program. Both Natural Resources and Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency help in delivering that program. Our Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever Farm Bill wildlife biologists do as well. And that's a very user-friendly opportunity for folks to get grassland work on the ground. The CRP program, however, does require, there are some eligibility requirements. So, for example, you would have had to have had cropping history on the acres that are enrolled in the program. There has to be what they refer to as, there's a score that's taken, biological index that's kind of helps determine eligibility as well. So that's one option. The second option, again, a USDA opportunity, is the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP for short. This program is administered by the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have specific practices in EQIP for grassland restoration for wildlife. And they can provide financial assistance to landowners interested in doing this work. So it's cost share. There's not an annual rental payment per se with this, but they're definitely available funds available to help offset the cost of the restoration, putting the grass on the ground, getting the drill rented, buying the herbicide. It's all available for folks. There is an application process as well, and there is a ranking and a scoring, but your Natural Resources Conservation Service staff or Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, Farm Bill wildlife biologists can help you through that and help you navigate those programs as well. So, those are two of many, but if folks are interested in doing this work, I would highly encourage them to reach out and just ask the question. If they want to reach out to us at Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, we're happy to help them get started, point them in the right direction. If we can't take them all the way, you know, these programs can be a little bit confusing, and we definitely don't want to see that be a barrier to anyone that's interested in putting grassland habitats on the ground. So we'll help you in any way that we can, and help find the program that best fits your goals and objectives.
So I got to say, I have not hunted pheasants in 20 years, Chris.
Well, that's ridiculous. We got to fix that.
I know that is bad. But despite that, I became a Pheasants Forever member a few years ago and have stuck with it because of the work like what you're describing. They're having biologists that are helping out with these things, and the way you guys are positively impacting grassland habitat across the country, which, despite not being a pheasant hunter, I love the grasslands and the Great Plains and have had some incredible deer hunting experiences in those types of habitats. So I'm a big fan of the work you guys are doing. So I would tell everyone that they should strongly consider supporting the work you guys are doing at Pheasants Forever. You guys have a great magazine too, which your members get, even though the pheasant hunting part isn't what's drawing me in, I'm really interested in like the habitat stuff you guys talk about in there. So good stuff across the board. That's my pitch. What would your pitch be to folks listening for why maybe they should check out PF and Quail Forever and any of the other work you guys have got going on?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I came to work here because of the habitat, you know, because of the mission. You know, this organization is as grassroots as they get. We do our best to do all we can to make a difference on the landscape for quail, for pheasants, for pollinators, for all kinds of wildlife species. And, we're here to make that landscape level change. And, you know, we'll, continue to do that. We want to continue to be in a position to make those impacts for a really long time. And so I encourage anyone that's interested in learning more about Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever to check us out on our website, www.pheasantsforever.org or www.quailforever.org. We're active on all social media platforms. Check us out and, you know, give us a look you know, we hope you come and be part of our family here.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I really do. Chris, is there, if there was someone who had been stuck on this hypothetical elevator I mentioned at the beginning when you pitched us on grassland habitat, what if we had been stuck on an elevator this entire time? The elevator had broken down. We've been stuck here. You've covered all this ground. You've talked about why grasses are great. You've talked about how they benefit deer and other critters and the land. We've talked through where to plant it, when to plant it, how to plant it. The elevator door finally is opening now. We're about to walk off. If you had any final parting thought you could share with this person who's now about to head to their car and get off this blasted elevator, is there anything else you'd say to them?
Well, for one thing, I'd have their name and their number, and I'd be following back up with them and making sure that they didn't forget that we talked. But I would tell them this is a game changer. This is this really is. These habitats are meant to be there. We use this cliche all the time, you know, build it and they will come. That's a fact with this. And you're never going to go wrong making the investment in putting grasslands on the landscape, putting grasslands on your farm. They're going to change how you hunt. They're going to change how you think about your property. They're going to change how you think about the landscape. So don't overlook it. It is a game changer.
Awesome, Chris. Well, you've got my name and number, so feel free to reach back out to me and check and see how I'm doing on some of these things. I've got some, I've got some old nasty, like fescue kind of habitat on a property I have permission on that for years now, I've known I've got to try to do something about it to convert it to something more useful. And this might be the kick in the tail to finally do it. So thank you for that, Chris. And thanks for all of this. This has been super helpful.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity. And again, happy to answer any questions that come our way. I could talk about this stuff all day, and I'll be, I'll be following up with you to see if you've gotten active there and got started on your project. Don't worry about that.
All right. Sounds good, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. And that is it for us today. Appreciate you tuning in. I'll let you go with just a final couple updates. Number one, we've got a sale from First Light. If you're listening to this just when it came out, there's a sale that started on April 26th, 2022 from our pals over at First Light, up to 20% off a whole lot of their stuff. So check it out at firstlight.com. Again, that's, you know, if you're listening to this just a few days after April 26th, 2022, sorry. If you're listening to this in 2025, probably still not going, but I do hope you're still listening in 2025, because that'd be good if this podcast is still running and helping people at that point. So fingers crossed. Other news, make sure you're signed up to the Wired to Hunt weekly newsletter. That's where me and Tony Peterson and all the other folks on our whitetail team are sharing our updates, our articles, our how-to videos, different things to help you on your deer hunting journey as well. So check those things out. I appreciate you. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And until next time, stay wired to hunt. Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.